Hi, and welcome to Community Conversations. I am joined here with my good friend, Keith McGill, who is a stand-up comedian and performing artist and teaching artist who has been working in Louisville and touring nationally, I would assume. I'm assuming you're tour nationally for decades, if not generations.
Yeah, well, just decades. It's not like my father's father was a teaching artist. So I guess it started with me.
Well, so years and years of experience. The point is that you're significantly older than me and you have a lot of experience.
Yeah, just barely, like 15, 20 minutes older.
So,
but
yes.
You look older, so that's really the trade-off.
It is fair. We're going to talk about a couple things, but tell me how COVID has impacted your career, which is very much centered. You do a whole lot of things and they all involve being in person.
Right. When like the week before they said nothing is happening, I was teaching 7 classes, like rotation. I was about to open at Commonwealth Theater Center in
a show that was so popular it need not be named.
Yeah, no, in Streetcar. And I was also about to do a comedy show, all of that stuff, and all of that stopped. Like, it literally stopped. Like, we got to dress rehearsal and no more. I had to stop teaching a class. There was one school that wouldn't even let me in for, like, the last class. Like, we're not letting any strangers in to the school for the last class. So,
Did you teach it through the window?
I didn't. I just went, well, good luck to you! It was actually a share day for the class. Like every this residency at the end, it's like, share what you know. So I did that.
Oh, I thought it was like a share day where they all did like a share impersonation.
If we could turn back town. No, it was, I mean, it was just all of it stopped. And fortunately I've been working so hard. Like I had no free time. Like I would have I'd come home for like 3 hours and then it'd be like, let's have dinner. And I'd be asleep. And then it would like get up at 5 and go to the gym and then go do things. And then, so it was like a cycle for a long time. So when it stopped and everything stopped, it took me about a week to get my bearings on the whole thing. And so eventually it just calmed down for me. I finally just had to go, do you have enough money? Do you have enough to eat? You know, I had to go on unemployment like a lot of artists, which thank God independent contractors were able to go on unemployment, because I'd really be in trouble probably right now. And I think that's because it's a new generation of people. The gig economy is so strong that we are going to have a lot more starving people if we don't do something. So, and then after a while, some other people said, okay, let's creep back into the water and see what we can do online. So I was working with a lot of theaters in town. I was working with the Actors Theater and Stage One, and so I was still able to do content type of thing because of PPP, so they could pay me as a temp. So that was good. But yeah, I mean, everything I was doing involved people being there, whether I was teaching somebody or doing a show or directing or acting. And if people can't gather, I can't do any of those things.
And for, you know, watching comedy, you know, it's one thing to, of course, be there in the room with somebody. And you watch a video of, you know, George Carlin doing a concert doing a routine to thousands of people and they're all laughing and you can laugh along. But watching somebody just kind of tell jokes to their screen with no reaction at all is right. A little bit of a different experience.
Well, the thing is, it's funny because I hadn't done any comedy for a month, 2 months after this started, because I thought it's just not going to be the same if I do it on a computer. And then I would watch all the late night guys doing comedy, and it took them a while to go, nobody will be laughing. This is literally just you talking to the camera in a monologue fashion, you know? And so I put my toe in the water. I did a show that was like 10 minutes. I had to do 10 minutes on the show, and it was really weird because they were trying to still figure out the sound. And if they left, you know, in a Zoom meeting, you leave the mics on or whatever. And then everybody, like, there's an echo and it was weird. And then the second show I did, they turned all the mics off. So I just saw people laughing, but I couldn't hear them. And I thought, well, this is weird too. And then because we'd been doing it for about a month, people realized they needed to tell people, hey, if your dog or your wife or your child runs in, or it's going to be super noisy, just mute us. And then when that's over, just take us off mute. So everybody's learning how to mute and unmute themselves and stop video and start video. I just did a show. In fact, last night I did a show for Gildas Club, which I imagine most people know, but it's basically a place where people with cancer can go and get help, get treatment. They have all kinds of facilities and they want to do a comedy night. And it was great. There was about 50 people in the room. Some people were on mute, some people weren't on video, but the people that were unmuted, I could hear the laughs. And so I was like, oh, okay, I can get the timing of this, right? Because the trickiest part of comedy is timing. And Zoom has an automatic delay. And so I thought, okay, so I don't want to say a joke and they don't hear it. But at the same time, I don't want it to be off. So let's like a 3-second thing where I'll go, and so then this happened. 2, 3, 4. Okay. You know, and you finally get the rhythm of it and it just turns out to be like really fun. So there's a new, I'm so tired of hearing the phrase new normal. I could shoot myself, but I think
now more than ever.
Yeah, now more than ever. We're in it together.
That's what I like to call it. I think that the history books will be the now more than ever period.
In a world. But I think we have to get used to a new way of doing things. Like this Zoom situation is here to stay. I have Zoomed with more people than I have actually just called or talked to, because it's like you can still talk to people, but you can also see them and see their reaction. So it's like the next best thing, actually talking to somebody directly. So we have to get used to the fact that the world is going to be different after this, during this. So I'm adjusting pretty well.
There's an upside to it in terms of accessibility. I mean, there's, you know, we've been doing a lot of digital programming with the Pride Foundation. And, you know, when we're going to continue that, even whenever we go back to the old normal or the new normal, because, you know, there are people who are not going to be able to get out to a club or a bar, you know, for any number of reasons. And so if we're bringing programming to people digitally, that makes it that much more accessible. And it's been interesting, you know, we had drag queens doing performances, and it started, you know, they would just be kind of on a background like I am and lip syncing. And then it was like moving into music videos and, you know, people were being creative with the new art form. So it'll be interesting to sort of see how people adapt to it long term. I wanted to ask you about, as a stand-up comedian, you know, how do you deal with trauma?
Right.
In the world. I mean, COVID was tough anyway. You know, it was kind of funny at first, and then it's like, oh, a whole lot of people are dying. Like,
right,
you know,
right. Or a lot of people are out of work, or this is very, a lot of people are super lonely and, you know, need their mental health issues.
Right.
Addressed.
Yeah. There was that Andy Beshear meme group, and it was, you know, everybody was having a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, this isn't really funny anymore.
Right.
And now on top of that, of course, we have the racial tensions and protests and rioting and, you know, police and military response and all of these sort of traumatic things going on. So how do you make people laugh during that?
Here's the thing about both. It's so interesting that, and I think without COVID, the tensions would not have been as high. I can't guarantee 100% that George Floyd would not have been murdered or Breonna Taylor would not have been murdered. But I can say that the fact that people are already so frustrated with COVID, and then there's the subgroup of people like Black people and other minorities, poor people, who are the subgroup of that. It's like, not only do you have to go through COVID, but now you've lost the job that you were hanging on to by your fingernails, and your healthcare is going to be even worse because you're even more disenfranchised. And more of you are going to get this because less of you have the protection from it, because either you don't have any way to get healthcare and fix it, or you work in a place for wage, you know, and you can't not work if they say come to work, but then it's a place like Amazon or, you know, places where it's like you're standing right next to people and you're not protected, and all of a sudden everybody's getting sick. So there was that frustration, and then couple it with the fact that a man is killed right in front of our eyes and nothing happens. Couple that with the fact that a woman is killed and there's no investigation and there's no action taken for months. Then it just like throws a match into the box of you know, Tinder. And all of a sudden it just explodes. And I think it would have exploded anyway, but I think the frustration, this is about more than police brutality and, you know, police killing people, you know, and it's also more than COVID, and it's also more than looting and rioting. It's all of those things. And it's a frustration and an anger that just explodes. So when you have that, it's hard. And I think with anything like that, it's hard to decide how funny is this. Like, quite honestly, we won't be able to joke about rioting for a long time because it's so hot and fresh and tender. COVID is a different thing because it's not you did this to me or because of who I am, this happened to me. COVID happened to everybody. And with talking about rioting, is what comedians and people call punching down, is that if I talk about rioting, I'm making Black people who are disenfranchised and the butt of the joke. If I talk about COVID, then I can talk about the administration, I can talk about the medical administration, I can talk about things like people having to learn Zoom or having to go out and shop at Pier 1 to get decent backgrounds, or the sheet sales have gone up because people have to buy sheets to put behind them so it looks like they live in a really cool studio when it's really just, don't come out of the bathroom for 20 minutes, I'm in a meeting. You know, I talk about stuff like, I know exactly what 6 feet is now. I can estimate 6 feet because I've been trying to eyeball it for so long, you know. And then I learned that 6 feet in nautical terms is called a fathom, which is great because if somebody's too close to me, I can say, get the fathom away from me.
It's unfathomable.
It's unfathomable how close you are to me. I'm going to steal that mic.
How long is a furlong? That's longer.
A furlong is 8 feet.
You know
I
what
should
else
know this. I live in Kentucky.
You know what else is 6 feet? Mark Twain.
Exactly.
I believe
six
that
feet
is,
down.
Yeah.
6 feet down.
Wow.
We should have
had this conversation so long ago.
We should have talked about weird measurements.
Right. Yes.
Furlongs and fathoms with Mike and Keith. Today we're going to talk about hectares.
You know, on a completely, completely unrelated side note, whenever I'm reading history and a new ruler comes in and they standardize the weights and measures in the kingdom,
I love that.
Like, this is my guy. That's, yeah, things are going to happen
that.
Now.
Like how a cubit changes or like horses are measured in hands.
Yeah.
You know, or an inch was like the length of whatever king's thumb. You know, it was very exciting. It just seems like, oh my God, I used to have so much more fabric. Now I only have 6 inches because the king is so short.
It's inflation.
It's inflation. We have such a tall king. I have no fabric.
So sorry to totally derail this conversation there.
It was so deep. And then there you went.
Yes. What is, but this is certainly not the first time in your career that you've, you know, that there've been very serious situations, but I mean, you can't go out and just tell a bunch of jokes and not acknowledge the situation, right?
Right. It's the elephant in the living room. Like I did a show last night, like I said, and I had to talk for at least 5 minutes about COVID because we were all going through it. It was like when I used to go to like Michigan and Wisconsin and Northern Ohio. And it wasn't like, you know, you're going to Cincy or you're going to Milwaukee. You know, it was like, you're going to, you know, Waukesha, Wisconsin, you know, or you're going to Superior, Wisconsin. And I'm the Black guy. So I would just start in on my show and people would be like, does he know he's Black? We can't ignore it. We can't hear you through your Blackness. And so then I would open the show with, hey, you know, some joke about me being Black or whatever. It'd be like, hey. When I walked in, the guy said, you must be the comedian. I said, what? Because I look like I might be a lot of fun. He's like, no, you're Black. We don't have any. And then once you do that and everybody can release that pressure valve, then you can talk about universal stuff. And that's the same thing with COVID. Like if you do a show and you don't say something about how COVID has affected you and is affecting people, then, you know, people don't think you're on the same team as them.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it happen a lot. Just again, a little aside, when somebody say from California comes to a Midwest club, sometimes they just go, and here are things that are happening in my life. And people go, we can't relate to that. Like, can you talk to me like a person who's not a comedian who flies around the country, you know? And so comedians do a little trick like, okay, what's the poor part of town? Or what's, you know, what happens around here? What's the weirdest thing? And then they'd say it on stage and go, oh, he knows our town. And really just ask some guy, what's the weird thing? So COVID is the weird thing. So you have to talk about it.
So I was just remembering after 9/11, then there's the whole documentary, The Aristocrats, about that famous joke, very filthy joke. And and the whole basis for that documentary was Gilbert Gottfried doing a set shortly after 9/11, like within weeks probably, and making a joke about getting a connecting flight that was like connecting through the Empire State Building, and people were booing him. And his response was just to tell the most offensive joke that anyone's ever heard, which was even better in his Gilbert Gottfried voice of just kind of yelling at you.
But, right, exactly. I actually, right after 9/11, it was probably 2 weeks after, there was a bike ride through Shakertown. And she said, we're gonna have the comedian, we gotta cheer this up, we gotta try to go on with our lives after this trauma. And so I get there, right? And I'm like, how am I gonna make these people laugh? This just happened, this is devastating to the country. And she handed me the best punchline I think I've ever seen in my whole life. Cause I asked her, I said, what is the prize for these things? And she said, well, you know, third prize is like, you know, X amount of money. Second prize is, you know, a hotel stay, blah, blah, blah. First prize was a plane ticket to anywhere in the United States. I thought, this is fat. This was like a gift from heaven. Because I get up there and I go, so first prize is a plane ticket anywhere in the United States. Well, that's worthless. Hey, I just biked 600 miles so I could stay home. Lucky you. And then just people just broke up. Cause again, it was like, okay, we're all holding this in and now we can let it go. And now we can just be here for a minute, you know? And it's funny because there's a fine line with that, because people say, what if you do? Don't talk about so-and-so. Okay, this has happened, but we don't talk about it. So as a comedian, what's the first thing you wanna do? Well, we're gonna talk about so-and-so. And I learned from that experience that you always have to make sure that you address the elephant in the living room. You always have to make sure that, okay, this is weird. I'm going to talk about it. Now you'll listen to me.
But there's some comedians who, you know, they make a point of breaking the taboos and just being as offensive as they can. And that's a very different thing than, you know, that's maybe punching down like you're talking about. Like, you have to find that way that we can all be in on the joke about this experience we've had.
Right. A lot of times people do this divisive comedy of us versus them, but it's like in the room. That's why I don't do directly political comedy. Two reasons. One, it just divides the room. No matter how you couch it, no matter how salient a point you make, there's going to be half of the people who are like, why is he talking about this? I came here to get away from this. The other thing is, you have to write all the time if you're going to do political humor. You have to always be writing because, you know, you can talk about whatever any administration has done, you know, a week ago, and now it's different. So now you have to write about the new thing. Like, you know, I can't still do Nixon jokes. You know, in the 70s, hilarious.
Right.
Not so much now.
Your Miller Fillmore routine.
Oh, my God. My Chester A. Arthur stuff. Woo!
Oh, boy, those wigs. I have no idea if Millard Fillmore was a wig, but maybe, probably. So how important, you know, you're a teaching artist. You do, you teach Shakespeare, part of the Shakespeare Behind Bars program.
Right.
How important is laughter the best medicine? Is it really?
It is.
Away COVID?
COVID? I hardly knew her. I didn't know what that meant. I think, honestly, there has to be, I mean, I think in classrooms, like when I go into, I'm talking to guys in Luther Luckett at Shakespeare Behind Bars, or I go into a school that's you know, all immigrants, because it's an ESL class and I'm doing a residency, I have to acknowledge their personhood as separate from everybody else's personhood, because this is a group of people who has been put in a certain class, a certain category. And so I have to address it, but I'm a guest in that room. So if I come and it's like, I have all this knowledge and you're lucky to get it. It's more like, hey, I'm coming in here and I have this if you want it, but it's an exchange. You have to tell me some knowledge. You also have to help me out. Because it's more of an empowerment thing than it is a, I have all the knowledge and you don't, because I had teachers who had all the knowledge. And I remember this one class where it was a college class actually. And I turned in a paper, and basically the papers were based on the lectures. It was like, okay, if you listen to the lectures, I'm going to give you this question and you're going to write a paper on it, but it's all the stuff I already said about the stuff. And so just tell me what I said, which I didn't realize. I really thought, you know, this person wanted original ideas, you know, or like you asked me a question. And if I can find evidence that you didn't give to support my point of view, I should be able to pass. And so I do this paper and I get a C. And I thought, a C? I mean, a B would be like, oh, I probably should have tweaked it more. But a C felt really like, you know, and I asked her. And she said, well, it was like you were never in the class. Now, this was, I think it was a feminist history class, or women throughout history, through literature, through accounts, et cetera, et cetera. I was the only male in the class. There were about 15 people, and I sat in the front of the class. And I was there every day. And she said, it was like you were never in the class. I'm like, you saw me in the class. And I told her, I said, you can't say I didn't, you know, support what I said. You know, you can say I didn't say exactly what you said. And she really had to think about that. She said, well, that's true. So it was that example of, okay, you come in here and you listen to what I say, and then you tell me what I say. And I feel really good about myself as a teacher, because I'm putting knowledge in your head. And I had that attitude when I first started being a teaching artist. And then I was like, I'm never going to reach these people, these kids, these students, if I don't accept the fact that I don't know everything when I walk in. I don't know everything about your life when I walk in. So you tell me something about your life and I'll listen. And that changes everything. Listening changes everything.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Sorry,
can't, you know, if you get a good joke, just keep it forever. That's my.
You do. Exactly.
So speaking about personhood, I want to ask you a series of very personal and invasive questions.
All right.
What's your favorite color?
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know it was going to take this turn, Michael.
Distinctly, the single question bit, you said.
Where is the leave limits. Meeting button? Because right. I cannot. I don't get to answer the question?
Yeah. No, you can.
Ask me a question, and then I don't get to answer? What is this, Congress?
Yes.
Blue is my favorite color.
Blue, that's a good color. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thanks.
So I want to talk about intersectionality and identity. And, you know, I've been talking to several people on the Community Conversations series here, talking to different African-American members of the LGBTQ community. And, you know, I'm interested to sort of hear a little bit about your experience and your perspective on things as a gay Black man, that people don't necessarily, you know, assume that you're gay when they meet you, and as also somebody who's in an interracial marriage. So
right.
we talk about intersectionality a lot, and I think you're at a different intersection.
Yeah, I was Black first, because that's what you do. And
when did you start that?
I'm going to say 64. And then I started to discover, wait, I think I'm gay. But here's the thing. Early on, and maybe still now, it was all right to be gay. Like, you can be the choir director, or you can be the florist in the town, or you can be gay, but don't be gay.
Or Floyd the barber.
Or Floyd the Bar. There you go. Wow. That's a whole other podcast. But you couldn't really, like, it was that elephant in the living room. Like, you know, we all knew the choir director was gay, but nobody ever mentioned it. Nobody ever said anything, because it's not a real thing. And so let's pretend it's not happening. So I think also because there has been so much emasculation since, you know, African people arrived on the first slave ship, that it's like, whatever you do, keep your manhood. You know, whoever you are, keep your, and that was always defined outwardly. It's like you're big and strong and muscular, and you know how to, you know, be in charge of your woman, and you don't let the white man beat you down. And so that is so ingrained, so that if you're gay or in any way a feminist, like, nope, we'll have none of that. That's just wrong. That's just blasphemous. That's a sin against God or whatever. So I grew up with that in my head. And then I just was like, what part do I get rid of? What part do I separate, you know? And then as I got older, it was very interesting to hear Bayard Rustin's story, because I found out Bayard Rustin was gay, but he was like, I'm gay and I'm black. And they said, okay, look, we're only fighting black battles right now. And we have to be squeaky clean and we have to be perfect. So if you could not be gay for this Martin Luther King thing, okay, we would really appreciate that. And so then you look at how he would have to hide this really important part of himself that was just as important as his blackness and his maleness, but I have to subjugate that because there's a bigger thing that I'm part of. And so I felt that for a long time. And I felt, honestly, when I came out, I thought everybody would just be like, duh, really? What? Big surprise. And most people were, honestly. Most people knew. Like, people know very early. I just made it official. So once I was out, I was like, oh, okay. But people are still surprised I'm gay. I mean, I have a joke about it in my show. I'm like, you know, I'll tell people I'm gay. They go, you are not gay. I am gay. It's like, well, you don't look gay. I'm like, how am I supposed to look gay? Like, I'm supposed to be walking around in a feather boa and a thong all the time? How am I supposed to look? It's not Tuesday. You know, I have when I teach, there's a group of kids I teach that are, I like to call them junior felons, which is just younger people who are like, if they don't stop doing what they're doing, they're going to end up, you know, in Luther Luckett with me and the older felon. And I'm very honest with them, you know, because if you're not honest with them, they won't be honest with you, and you have no relationship. And they'll ask me, are you married, Mr. Keith? No, you have a girlfriend, Mr. Keith? No. And finally, I just say, guys, I'm gay. I'm just going to put it out there. You can do with that what you want to. You know, nothing you can say is going to hurt my feelings. I'm 4 times older than you. What can you do? And there was one kid who was like, you ain't no gay, Mr. Keith. And I said, well, I am some gay. All of this, the whole, I am all gay, I guess, is, if we're qualifying the amount of gay, all of this.
A fathom of gay.
I am a fathom of gay. Again, callback. So for me, it's, I've never been in a situation where, all right, I have to put this away so I can fit into this world. And then, on top of it, my partner is white. And there's never been a moment where I was like, I'm with a white man. What does that mean? How is that different? Like, I've never gotten any grief. Like, why are you with that white man? I've really never gotten that. And I never really questioned it or thought, am I betraying my race at being with a white man? You know, it's like, no, this is the guy I fell in love with and he's nice to me. So that's all I really require. And so that, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I need to. And we're back with Keith McGill.
Hi.
I'm talking about the unfathomable gayness of being. Sorry, I had to cut you off there briefly for a software issue, but you were talking about your husband.
Yes, my white husband. We're not officially married, though, is the thing. We've been together No, not really, because we might as well be married. We've been together for literally 29 years, which is a long time. That's like 203 in straight years. That's a long time.
Roughly the same time that I've been alive.
Yes.
Roughly, as I celebrate. Yeah, yeah, very roughly. Birthday.
Like we're rounding everything to the nearest 100. That's exactly your age.
Yes.
But we will probably have a ceremony because, like, it's something I would like to do, just, you know. I mean, but we've done all the legal stuff, you know, power of attorney and, you know, medical who's he what's and, You get my stuff, I get your stuff. So that was all taken care of. Because here's the other thing. We weren't really looking at, well, in our lifetime, we'll be able to get married. It's like, I don't think so. People are pushing back against this thing. So let's get our ducks in a row. You know, so, you know, there's no trouble if I want to visit you at the hospital. I've seen too many Lifetime movies of the week to be all fast and loose with it. So, but then now we can get married, you know. And I talk about, it's funny because when gay marriage was first official for everybody, a friend of mine, a straight friend of mine, really good friend, came up to me and said, well, when are you and Jim going to get married? And I went, I don't know. We'll get married at some point, I guess. It's like, well, you can get married now. Why aren't you married? I'm like, you have been able to get married since they invented marriage. Why aren't you married? And then I said, there must be some gay guys who are like really upset that this has happened, because that was their way out. It's like, baby, I would marry you tomorrow, but these people are keeping us apart, right? And I was like, you can all get married. And he's like, oh, damn it. You're messing up my thing. I had a thing.
We got married that weekend. And I don't know when, like, it was like, you know, because we'd always said we weren't going to do it until it was legal. And it was like, oh, okay, let's go do it. And if we hadn't done it right then, I don't know when we, you know, we probably would still.
Exactly. Like, do it right now or just right. We'll get to it.
It was like an impulse buy, you know.
I got to, right. You were at the checkout line. You got some gum and a marriage.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you know, you've never felt like you had to put your gayness away. Right. Which is good, because there's not a large enough package to put
so
your gayness.
So much gayness. In. Oh, my goodness.
Do you ever have to put your blackness away as somebody? I mean, you travel in some very white worlds.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, like you were talking earlier about being in Wisconsin and, you know, being the right. one black person right. in the city, if right. not the county. You know, what's your experience been like on that side?
The thing about that, about being like the one black person in that county, is that I can't put it anywhere, right? It's the times I'm most aware of being black is when the time everybody around me is most aware of my being black. Like, I'm not right now, you know, I'm not, just because we're talking about it, I'm thinking, oh yeah, I'm black. But it's not like I walk around all the time going, I am black. I am black here in the Kroger, getting my car washed, and I'm black. You know, it's not, I'm not fully aware of it. Like, I'm not wearing it on my sleeve. It's like, how you doing? I would like a Big Mac and large fries and a Coca-Cola, and I'm black. I'm not doing that, right? I'm just living my life. The only time I'm made aware of it is when something in society says, oh, you're black, by the way. Where are you on this? Like, in the middle of all of this, you know, the police brutality and the rioting. Like, I'm always very aware I'm black when I'm in a suburb or in Prospect or, you know, something like that. It's like, okay, you have to be really cool, really careful. Like, if I drive to Georgia, I'm like, look, do not speed. Those are the moments when I'm aware of my blackness, because I'm being made aware of my blackness. But otherwise, I'm not. Just like I'm not wearing my gayness around all the time. I just am. And if I do something that seems black or seems gay, it's me doing it. It's not a black person being black or a gay person being gay. It's me being me, you know, and that part of it may be also considered a trait of blackness or a trait of gayness. But I can't monitor that all the time, because then I would never have a break from the constant monitoring that the world is putting on blacks and on gays and males. Because now with, you know, the Me Too movement and all of these harassment suits coming to light and all of these people saying it happened to me, or this guy did this to me, or this woman in some cases did this to me, I'm very aware of being male. And so I'm very aware of my language. I'm very aware of, you know, how I approach women, how I approach men, how I approach kids. Like, is what I'm doing going to be misconstrued in some way?
Especially working with a lot of students and working right. with incarcerated people, you right. know, all sorts of situations where there's a power imbalance.
Right, right. You have to be very aware of, is what I'm doing going to make somebody uncomfortable? And the thing is, and this is what people don't understand about all of this, about being black and, you know, with a world full of whites, being, you know, gay in a world full of straights, being a woman in a world full of males, whatever that is, whenever you are the minority as you, as it is, the minority determines when it's uncomfortable. And I think a lot of people don't seem to understand that about any of these situations. It's like, I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable, but you did, and that's enough. It's like, but that wasn't my intention, but you did. You know, I'm a hugger. Well, don't hug me. What you are is of no concern to me because you're crossing my boundary. It's like when people talk about, and I've had this conversation, I've had it with two or three Black people, but not a couple of white people. Because again, there's this whole binary thing, and I think it's so much stronger in with Black people, which is ironic because there are so many different levels of really just race. It's like, you know, I'm Black, but my mother is white, so but you're still Black. I'm Black, but I'm a quarter Cherokee, but I look at you and I see Black. Mm-hmm. So the definition of Blackness is so specific. So when I talk to people about trans people, and you'll meet somebody, it's like, well, my pronouns are they, them, and theirs. And, you know, I have friends who look at me and go, what is that? Because I'm evidently like the queer, you know,
queer,
consultant.
Queer whisperer.
Yeah, the queer whisperer. Like, listen, what he meant is.
What they meant.
What they meant. And they'll ask me, it's like, well, why can't, he looks like a boy. It's like, it doesn't matter what he looks like. They want to be called them. Right? So why is that so hard? Like, what if somebody wants to change their name from Susan to Connor? What does that take away from you? And I think what happens is people look at this and go, I thought I knew exactly how the world works, and I don't. And once I thought I had it figured out, you changed how it is by saying, look, I am a trans person, I am a woman, therefore I'm identifying as trans, even though biologically, I am male appearing, whatever that means. Or I might think I feel like a woman one day and feel like a male the next day. I'm gender fluid, which is just Katie bar the door. They just, you know, big explosion. And I just go, look, what are your pronouns? What name would you like to be called? Great. And we're done. And it's just, it simplifies it for me. Rather than trying to figure out, well, why is this and why do I just go, okay, you want to be called Chris. Okay, that's great. And you are, you identify as a male. Great. And we're done. Go ahead.
Well, so many of these things, it's like people, you know, you don't have to get it to respect somebody, you know? Right. And I always think religion is a pretty good metaphor. Like, you don't have to believe in someone's religion to respect it and get that, you know, it's okay for them to go to a synagogue instead of a church. Like, you know, that's, yeah, you don't have to understand it and feel it and experience it because you can't. It's not your experience.
It is literally when your beliefs cross into my right to not believe it. You know, when I don't believe that you should be calling yourself Connor when you were born Susan. It's like, well, I don't care what you believe. This is who I am. I don't believe in Judaism. I don't care what you believe. I believe in Judaism. Or I believe everybody should believe in Judaism. You can't make me believe what you believe. You can believe it. I can respect it. When I talk to you about it, I'll treat it respectfully. But if I'm agnostic or if I'm Catholic or if I want to worship a pair of tennis shoes, then you can't come to me and go, well, that's wrong, your tennis shoe worship. It's like, who are you to say that? And that's the whole of the problem, is that people think make it easier for me. Make the world easier for me. Don't make me change my mind about things. Don't make me think about things. Don't make me shift how I feel about things. Therefore, what you're thinking is wrong. Otherwise, I have to shift my belief. You challenge my belief. But what good is having a belief if it doesn't get challenged?
That's what makes so many of these conversations so challenging right now, is you're talking about, you know, our concepts of patriarchy are so deeply ingrained in our identity as Americans, and racism is so deeply ingrained, subliminally ingrained in everything about America, that when you start challenging those ideas, it really does get to people's identity. You know, and it's very difficult for them to except that the narrative they've been told about our history may not be complete, or, you know, their view of the world may not be accurate. You know, right. that's a big shift. And I think a lot of people just shut down and don't want to accept that.
Right. Right. Because then what you have to do is you have to take some action, not responsibility. And I think this is the difference. I don't know if you feel this way or not, you can tell me, but if I say to you, Mike, for years, white people have controlled everything and it's been systematic racism and all of these institutions started because it was just to use black people as monetary units for a long time and eventually just to create more money for white people. You could say, wow, that sucks.
What do you want me to do about it?
Right. There's your choices. Like, that's exactly it. What can I do about it? Or what do you want me to do about it? Those are the two choices.
I didn't do it. Yeah.
I didn't do it. And so people feel like you have to take all the responsibility because your ancestors were white. Your ancestors owned slaves. Therefore, it's your fault I live here. No, it's not. It's their fault. Just like it's not anymore your fault that you live here. Right. But now that we acknowledge, yes, there's a system in place that some people were directly feeding into on purpose. We need to be anti-racist, which people like, what's the difference between I'm not racist? There's a difference between non-racist and anti-racist, right? Racism, this is what I figured out after all these days of thinking. Racism is active. I'm going to tell a horrible joke. I'm going to pay you less money. I'm going to make sure that you only live in this neighborhood. That is an active thing. You're doing that on purpose. Non-racist is passive. I'm not hitting black people with a baton. Therefore, I'm not a racist. Good for me, right? What we need to be now is anti-racist. Not only am I not hitting black people with batons, I'm saying to you, stop hitting black people with batons. And I'm gonna see if I can't get a law change so that you stop hitting black people with batons, even though I'm not a black person. And I think there's this, not anger necessarily, but it's like this, I've heard this before, when people say, we stand with you, Black Lives Matter, we're in your corner, this is wrong. Okay, good. Now, all you companies who wanna make sure black people still come to your stores or still buy your coffee or still drive your cars, do something directly associated with stopping racism. Don't just go, I got my black square up. Okay, woo, that was close. So come get some coffee.
We're standing here.
We're right here. We're right here. I got a sign. What do you want me to do? I want you to specifically hire people of minority or disenfranchised people in these positions of power. I want you to change it. Next time you hire somebody on purpose, hire this person specifically. I specifically want to get a Latin person on the board. And that person has power. It's not just, look, we've got a Latin. We've done it. No, we have a Latinx person who actually makes decisions. And they can be on purpose decisions that will benefit the Latinx community.
And
we've
been talking about that for decades. And that's the idea behind what is known as affirmative action, the concept of you have to take affirmative action. You have like that, that's become such a, affirmative action is like just a phrase that we forget, like the meaning behind it is it's not just negative action. It's not just not being racist. Like you say, you have to be proactive. You have to be affirmative. You have to go the extra step because the status quo is racist. So if you're neutral, you're just going along
then with you're just going quo. Along with racism.
Yeah.
You're not adding to it, but you're not doing anything to fix it. It's like, all right, so I'm making soup and oh my God, I put too much salt in the soup. Well, no, I didn't put too much salt. Somebody else put too much salt in the soup. And I just go, there's too much salt in the soup. Stop putting salt in the soup. No more salt. No more salt. Right? Instead of being like, how can we get the salt? Wait, I have a potato. Put a potato in there. Get the salt out of the soup. It's the same idea.
Be the potato.
Be the potato in the salty soup.
That's a good motto. I think, why was that not caught on yet?
Because I just made it up.
You know, there's an interesting paradox that I have noticed in this where we talk about how to be anti-racist. Okay, so we're not just going to take a stand. We're not just going to put a sign up and say we stand in solidarity. We're going to do something. And there's this paradox of like, it's not the job of people of color to tell white people what to do.
Right.
And yet white people also do need to follow the leadership of people of color. So that's like right. this paradox of listening, and, you know, and I think the resolution of the paradox is you listen, you understand, you hear. The message is clear about what needs to be done. You know, right. you don't need to go up to somebody and ask them, you know, the information is out there to act on. But I think there's a lot of times when white people, and I'm guessing knowing you personally, Keith, I think you're probably are you the only black person that a lot of white people know?
I really am, or very close to it. Like when all like of this rioting started. Like the Venn diagram,
I don't know how you would chart that.
And people's hearts are so in the right place, and I can't come down on anybody.
First off, but God bless them.
I got more "Are you okays?" than I've ever gotten in my whole life. Like I got emails, and I got Facebook messages, and I got, you know, I mean, I got some when COVID started because everybody was checking on everybody. But right. then when this hit, it's like boom, 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 bing, 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 bing. You all right? You okay? This is horrible. I'm so sorry. I love you. I love black people. I love you. You know, and I know. Because people just, and that's the first step. The first step is to be like, I need to care about somebody I know who's probably personally going through this. Mm-hmm. Do I know any black males who might get their heads beat in? Wait, I do. And then they contact that black person. They go, okay, I checked on my black friend. And that's great. Now, worry about all that. What can I do to help all the other people's black friends?
And right? don't use that person as your personal therapist. Like, you can't be the therapist to 50 white people.
Right.
Who are working their way.
I feel so awful about this. Blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah. Like, I'm so sorry. You know, I had no idea. What do I do? That, you know, that's right. a lot of emotional labor that we put on people.
And when people ask me, what do I do? And I say, you know what? Some people march in the streets. Some people are legislators and get laws changed. Some people hire directly into other minorities. If you can't do any of those things, stop somebody from telling a racist joke. Leave the room when somebody says a racial slur. Teach your children never to use this language and teach them and perpetuate that, because it's going to take several generations for this to change, because it took 400 years to put it in place. And it's still going on. It's not even stopped. It's not even better. It's just different. Like, it's a different type of racial oppression. And it's like, now it's a system that's just, it's there. It's the system.
It's so disheartening to see how little things have changed.
Right.
Even though things have changed. I mean, there has been progress in some ways, but my God, like, we're right where I've just been watching Star Trek recently, and like this view of, you know, in 200 years, racism will be gone.
Right.
You know, like what, and I think people, you know, watching in the 60s were like, oh, cool. You know, right. we're like that was more plausible than it is now.
Well, and the thing too is, it's kind of like, we're supposed to have flying cars by now.
Right.
Because we watched the Jetsons, but unless somebody sits down and goes, how can I make a car fly? We're not going to have flying cars. Right? People are just waiting. Any second now, flying car. Can't wait. We're not going to have flying cars unless somebody is working on a flying car. We're not going to end racism unless a lot of people are working on ending racism, because we are all part of that system. And I have flashes in my head too. And it's things I've been told by society. It's things my own family has told me about how black people are, how gay people are. And so there's, if you will, internalize racism, internalize homophobia, internalize misanthropy, I guess.
You can't not have it. You're getting right. all of those messages right. daily from the media. I remember, I mean, I work very hard on these sort of things, but when everybody started wearing masks, the first time I was walking down the street and there was an African-American man with a mask, there was just a second in my head.
A moment.
Oh, what's, you know, because that's the picture of a villain that I've seen
right,
in
right.
1,000 movies. And right. my brain has learned that, you know, because it's a good computer, and it's like, hey, wait a minute. There's a big black guy with a mask. That's bad news.
Right. Know? And that's what I tell people about stereotypes, is that your brain doesn't want to work real hard. So it makes about 7 or 8 connections and goes, all right, human, done. I don't really need to see gender. I don't really need to see color. I don't need to know if they're short or tall or whatever. And then it's got to make another connection to go, human, you know, tall, short, human, blue eyes, brown eyes, human, skin color. It's got to make all of those connections, right? And then once it's done it, once it said black male, it's got to go farther than that. And it doesn't want to go any further than that because it's like black male, gay, black male secretary, black male president, black, you know, it's got to parse it out even more. And it's like, really, I just black male felon, I'm done. You know, black male criminal, I'm done.
Because it gets a whole lot of evidence to support that.
Right.
From the media.
Because other people are feeding that same, it basically is strengthening all those neural pathways in your brain every time the media comes on. Just like right now, all cops horrible. All cops horrible, you know? And we have to really fight to be like, not all cops are horrible, but the system in which the cops work are horrible. So it can't help but make horrible cops. Even if you're trying not to be a horrible cop, there's somebody trying to make you a horrible cop because that's how the system works, right? And so you have to get rid of the people who are making horrible cops so that you can have less horrible cops. I just heard this on the radio. There was a city in New Jersey, and my God, I can't remember what the name of the city is. But they basically said, all right, we are firing all our cops. If you want your job back, you have to reapply.
Camden.
And they reapplied. And some of them didn't get back in. It's like, nope, you're not fitting the, yeah, I don't know what happened, but you can't be a cop anymore because we're changing this dynamic. And I'm sure there was a lot of flack behind it. I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, misinformation. Like, if we don't have cops, we'll all be killed. They're just going to kill us all. And they didn't. Just like these cops in Buffalo who are like, we quit. And so what will happen is arrests will go down. And all of the prosecutions will go down. But the world won't end because, one, a lot of the arrests are being made for misdemeanor ridiculousness. You know, it's like, you have marijuana, you're going to jail. You know, you were jaywalking, you're going to jail. You know, somebody called the police and you're going to jail. So if we pare down the squad, I'm not saying that's a permanent thing. I'm not saying that's a thing that we have to do everywhere. But if we pare it down, just like with COVID, they said, okay, if you have a fender bender, we're not coming out for a fender bender because we got bigger fish to fry. It's too dangerous. You know, get exchange numbers or just go on with your life. It's the same thing. If some hysterical white woman in a park is saying, this man is harassing me, they have to go further. They have to be like, well, is he touching you? No.
Can you point your camera at him?
Yeah, yeah. So how far? So he's very far away from you.
He's
watching. So he probably can't hurt you. You should just leave the park and goodbye. You know, rather than, well, we're bored policemen and so we don't have anything else to do. So we're going to go and check up on this thing. And then once we get there, we're policemen. We have to police. Like,
a lot of times. You have to justify all this big equipment
we've
got.
Yeah, policemen aren't taught how to not police. Like, how can I make my job less work? Like, can I go somewhere and be like, hey, let's try to get along, all right? You should go home now and stop drinking. Okay. And that's the other part of it. It's like policemen are expected to be mental health workers and social workers and referees and arbiters and all of these things. Because we are cutting all the money. And so people who have mental health problems, people who need to be on medication, people who are disenfranchised, people who are homeless because they don't have enough money because there are no services and they were half an inch away from being homeless and here they are because that service has been taken away, end up on the street. And so then, oh, just give them to the police. Give them to the police, the police will deal with it. That's what they're there for. I saw this woman, and this was a couple of years ago. I remember it was the day after St. Patrick's Day because in the Highlands, the streets were a mess, and it was raining. And I saw this woman and she was kind of staggering. And I thought, oh my God, she's wandering home from St. Patrick's Day. And then I saw the telltale hospital socks they give you with like the grips on the bottom. And I went, no, this woman has left the hospital. Probably of her own accord, but it looks like a very bad idea. And I was going to Starbucks to get a gift card for a friend of mine. And she came into the Starbucks And the woman behind the counter was like super friends, like, hey, how you doing? It's great. Welcome to Starbucks. And this homeless woman comes in. She's like, you have to get out. You can't be in here. You have to get out. I went, why can't she be in here and just sit down? You know, and it was raining and it was cold. And, you know, you have to be here. You can't. And then she immediately calls the police to get her out. Because that's the police's job to help the homeless, right? Because we've made it their job. There's nobody they can bring to, like, you know, maybe get this woman some shelter. It's like, well, it's police. We don't have any social workers who can run along because we've taken all their money and we only pay them $17 a week anyway. So the police, like, she goes outside because a woman is throwing her out and she doesn't want to go to jail or cause trouble. And I see her, my heart just like cracks in half, right? I'm like, I'm going to buy this woman like a cake pop or a cup of coffee. And so I walk over to her and I said, hey, what's going on? She's like, I just wanted to sit inside. It's so cold out here. And she starts crying and I'm crying and we're just crying. I'm like, I know, I'm so sorry. Can I get you a cake pop? What can I do? And she said, oh, and finally the policeman comes and I said, and I told him the whole deal. I'm like, you know, she went inside because it's cold and it's raining and she didn't have anywhere to go and da, da, da. And so he's talking to her and he was very kind. He was a really nice guy. But I'm just like, that shouldn't be a policeman's job to figure this out. A policeman can come in case somebody's unruly and he has to, you know, help with the situation, but he shouldn't have to go around and make sure homeless people know where the shelter is. There should be somebody who can go with him depending on what the call is. You know, there's a man who's asleep in front of the Walgreens. He doesn't need a policeman with a taser.
We've criminalized poverty, we've criminalized homelessness, we've criminalized mental illness, we've criminalized drug addiction. All of these things are thought of primarily as criminal activities and not social service problems, which is really what they are.
Right.
And then you take, you know, and one thing, it's like the war on drugs is not getting talked about a lot right now as part of this.
Because they're not really good at it.
Because there's so much, there's so much going on.
But they're not good warriors.
You know, we do arrest people and we send them to jail. And it's like they didn't have, you know, it was possession of marijuana. And now they're going to come out and they're going to be a felon. They're never going to be able to get a job. They're going to have a record. And the only skills they've probably learned are the skills they learned in prison. How to be a better criminal.
Exactly. You know,
so it's like it is the perfect storm, vicious circle that just, you know, every action we take exacerbates the problem even more.
Right. I did and I got to do it a couple of times. It was great. I wish I got to do it more because it was so helpful to me. There were these people who were part of Seven Counties, which is now Cornerstone or Centerstone. And
Coldstone Creamery.
And they were telling me their stories about how mental illness, you know, tripped them up and how they're in recovery and how they're working it out. And there was one guy who got mental illness treatment because he was sent to prison and they had a psychiatric facility. He had no idea he was bipolar because no one in his family talked about it. No, we don't talk about that. You just, you know, need to straighten yourself out. You need to cheer up and you need to calm down or whatever it is people say when you're in one of those states. And because his brain was not functioning properly, he did this really huge criminal act. I think he attacked someone. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it sent him to prison. And in prison, they evaluated him and said, oh, you have bipolar disorder. And they treated the bipolar disorder in prison, which they, if he had been able to do that outside of prison and somebody recognized it and said, oh, wait, you've got bipolar disorder, we can help you before it gets too far out of hand, he wouldn't have had to go to prison. But, I mean, again, another tangent, the prison system makes money and has free labor. So we're gonna try to get as many people in prison as we can.
But the flip side is, if we had treated that person at a clinic and not incarcerated them, we would have spent so much less taxpayer money.
Right.
You know what, this person, they have a condition and we're gonna have to put them on disability. And we're going to have to, you know, we're going to pay for their drugs and their housing for the rest of their life. That would still be cheaper than putting them in prison.
Right.
You know, but somehow, but then and I fundamentally think that the thing that holds America back more than anything else is the fear amongst about 40% of the population that their tax dollars are going to go to some black person who's going to get something for nothing.
Who is living welfare rich. I had a friend of mine talk to me about that, about the CARES Act where everybody gets $600 every 2 weeks for X amount of weeks. And this friend was saying, well, now these people are just going to take this money and they're just going to live. They're not going to want to work again. They're just going to sit at home. And she was serious. Like, this was a friend who I thought was pretty enlightened.
They're just going to be buying menthol cigarettes.
Right. They're going to be buying cigarettes and they're going to be, you know, I said, you know what these people, or they might do something crazy, like try to keep their house and buy feed groceries. Their kids. That's lunatic. That's insane. What you mean to tell me you take somebody's job away and they're just going to live high? Now, not for nothing. Somebody's going to buy a pair of Nikes. Somebody's going to buy a pair of Air Jordans. Somebody's going to buy a flat screen TV with this money. Yes, they are. The vast majority of people are just trying not to lose their houses or their apartments or their cars. There are people who are out of work now who, like, I just need enough money so I can keep my lights on. And this idea that, oh, they're taking advantage of me, these millionaires who are sitting around talking about these poor people are taking advantage of me and I won't, let me get on my private plane and talk to you about this. You know, let me go to one of my three or four houses I own and talk about how the poor people are just taking advantage. Oh, by the way, I haven't paid taxes since 1987.
Right. And it's, I mean, all
but
of
the, I'm not on welfare. I'm just smart.
All of the assistance programs are a fraction of the budget, you know, and if we, I mean, if we did universal basic income and Medicare for all and all of these sort of things, it, you know, we would have to cut the military budget by, you know, 1 or 2% or something like that.
Right. That means no Space Force.
Right. Right.
I can't even. A man on the radio. There was a policeman on the radio because they were saying, okay, so people are trying to explain what defund the police force is. Now, people want to appeal to the lowest common denominator. So they take it to an extreme that's not even possible, that would never, ever
happen. We're literally going to hire people to murder you.
Right. Right. So basically, you know, people have been talking, defund the police force means they take all the money away from the police. That means we have no police. That means there's chaos reigning. That means it's the purge. No. Obviously, defund means let's take some of this money and put it somewhere else so we don't need the police to do anything but police, mm-hmm. right? To actual catch actual criminals who are actually committing crimes. So when you have people saying that, and then you have, there was a policeman who said, they're funding these ridiculous things. Like they want $15,000 for a transgender protection fund or something like that. That's ridiculous. They're just throwing money away. Now the budget for that particular police force, $193 million. Which meant that was like 0.001% or 0.008% of that budget.
But that's people, about the same amount as the Metro police budget here. It's about $191 million.
Right. And I think a lot of that money is evidently going to pepper spray and tear gas because they want to use it up before it goes bad. It's like, you see the expiration on this tear gas day. It's not going to produce nearly as many tears if we let it get to, you know, July 2020. So we better use this up now because it's just taking up room.
Well, I don't know if that was a good note to stop on, but you know, we got to stop.
See, again, it's the whole, when is this funny?
Right. Well, and all of these issues, they all flow right into it. Oh, I had this brilliant thing I was going to say because we were talking about Space Force. You know, do we feed people or do we have Space Force?
And right.
It gets back to, you know, 50 years ago. What I think is the greatest poem of the 20th century is Gil Scott Heron, Whitey on the Moon. And he's talking about, you know, it's you know, all of the horrible things are going on in his life and the world around him, and Whitey's on the moon. And it's just, it like, it's the most powerful, you know, indictment of just like, what are we doing? What are we doing with our money? We can put a man on the moon. We can put force into space, whatever that is. And we cannot, you know, just take care of ourselves.
To be fair, NASA has done great things for society. Like literally, we wouldn't have satellite TV. We wouldn't be able to do a lot of the things we do if it wasn't for NASA. But
that is true.
Something like, let's just go to Mars. Why? Why? Because that attitude of Earth is the most important planet in this solar system. So we should be going to other planets because we know how to do that. But there's no real reason to do it, except for the fact that, you know, in the 50s, we heard Russia was doing it. So we got to be first.
We got to do it.
We got to be first. And so that's why they call it the space race. And then once you're in and you put all this money and you have a budget already set up, it's like anything. I mean, you used to work with companies where it's like, once you have this space in the budget, you always had to put money in that space.
Oh, yeah.
Because we always have. So we always had to put money in the NASA budget.
The nature of bureaucracy and organizations is people will find ways to spend that money.
Right.
But all right, I'm going to cut it here because we could go on all day. But thank you for joining me, Keith, we talked about everything from qubits to fathoms.
We did. We talked all the measurements.
All the measurements, all the marbles. So thank you very much. I'm looking forward to when we'll get to be, you know, performing and seeing performances live again.
Live people.
But I guess it's probably been not being funny for several months. It's probably been a nice change of pace for you.
It was funny. This show I did the other night, I was very nervous about it. It's like, what if I'm not funny anymore? What if I say all these words and people go, remember when he was funny? And then all of a sudden I just see all of these blocks just disappearing off the Zoom meeting. Like, wait, don't go, GL23. I can be funny.
Non-video participants.
Why are you blacking out your screens?
That's the saddest idea. There's just all these little squares and they all just join to until it's your
bleep,
mom.
Bleep, bleep, bleep. It's down to your mom and the host.
And then your mom leaves.
And then your mom's like, sweetie, I love you. Bleep.
All right, I'm just going to stop recording because we're not going to have any